Well, for those of you who are just joining us, we started out this year looking at the concept of being pleasing to God, and then we kind of moved to being filled and controlled by God's Spirit. And then last week we kind of started looking at one of the major obstacles to being controlled by God's Spirit, and that's our pride. So we kind of examined the concept of pride. We saw that it prevents us from having the kind of intimate relationship with God that He intends. And it also prevents us from having the kind of relationship with others that He intends. When I was trying to figure out how to remove the hostility in my class that felt towards me as a result of how they did on the midterm to a more neutral stance, one of the things I started talking about is relationships, and they always love talking about relationships. And that's true in almost any environment, and one of the reasons why is because we're so bad at them. And one of the reasons we're bad at them is because of pride. So it hinders our relationship with God, and it hinders our relationship with others. Last week we saw at the top of the outline from last week, in fact at the top of this one too, that pride is an improper or distorted focus on ourselves. And that focus on ourselves makes us insensitive to God and makes us insensitive to others, to the needs that others have. So as a result, we don't develop a relationship with them. When we're insensitive to God, we live independently of Him. He can't bless us when we're living independently of Him. When we're insensitive to others, we wind up using them. And the relationships of people using each other don't last or endure really well. So we saw part of the corrective was developing a Christ-like mindset. You seek to look to God to meet your needs like Jesus did, and then you're free to meet others' needs. You view yourself as a servant of others, and you view yourself as a servant of God. And you live happily ever after. Now, that's the truth. If you apply it, you live happily ever after. That's nothing else. There's no magic silver bullet. That's all it takes. Problem is, it's a lot easier said than done. So what I'd like to do today is explore the concept of pride a little more. Maybe we'll get to a little humility. But that's what the second page is. This is another outline from days gone by. Pride is a peacock. One of the major problems in trying to help people with pride is that they don't realize that they're prideful. Or if they are prideful, they're proud of it. they wear pride as a badge. Oh, I really have a problem with pride. No, my problem with pride is bigger than your problem with pride. And we basically put down someone else to make ourselves feel good, and doesn't work too well. If you've ever doubted that you have a problem with pride, you've got a problem with pride. We all do. It's just part of being human. The issue is, how do you deal with it? It's a very insidious thing. It's very invasive. If it tripped up Satan, why would anybody think they're immune to it? We tend to view Satan as this, horrible, decrepit, evil thing. And, at least he's horrible and evil, but he's not very decrepit. He was the highest created being. He had, perfection in almost every area of his life. And he got tripped up. Now, if he's going to get tripped up, there's a good likelihood we'll be tripped up. The thing that tripped him up is what he's going to use to trip us up. Jesus was tempted in the area of pride when he was out in the wilderness. Even he has the susceptibility towards it. So, if you don't think you have a problem with pride, you might need to think again. Under number two at the top, Roman number one, pride results in a futile pursuit of power, pleasure, and significance apart from God. The essence of sin, if I understand things, is independence. We live independently. We go to seek our own power, our own security, our own significance. We seek our own possessions, except for cell phones, of course, independently of God. We seek pleasure apart from God, and it's doomed to futility. It's doomed. I'll talk more about that a little further down below. Number three, pride prevents or ruptures relationships, and it prevents ruined relationships from being restored, and it renders us incapable of experiencing real love, because people who haven't learned how to deal with pride have a wall built up around them that insulates them from need and from others. And one of the essence of love is this mutual need meeting. And if you never have any needs, you can't experience anyone else meeting those needs. And if you're behind this wall, you're not going to be able to meet someone else's needs. So it cuts you off for something that, you know, we seek after from the cradle, and that is love. So we'll talk about how to hopefully fix that. And last but not least, pride cuts us off from God. It makes us unblessable. The scary thing is, not only does it make us unblessable, but I don't know if you've seen this in the scriptures, God actively opposes the proud. He actively does that. And how would you like to think your opponent in life is God? I've heard the title of a book from when I was in high school. It said, "Your arms are too short to box with God." So, I mean, you really don't want to have God be opposing your happiness. If you're at all concerned with that happiness, you kind of learn to eventually need to do things God's way. So before we get into that, I want to take a look at the various types of pride. I can't remember how this got put together, but it covers most of the areas. I think I did this as a follow-up to various fruits of the flesh, things that are done temporally, independently of God's Spirit. And the first one everyone can relate to, it's called self-righteous pride. This is the stuff that keeps us from even developing a relationship with God because we think we're good enough apart from it. Now, I used to think this was ridiculous until I actually ran into a person that honestly and truly believed this. About 25 years ago, back in the dark ages, Joel and I took a youth group down to a Bill Gothard seminar in Ocean Grove from upstate New York. We took a group of kids down. Someone said, "Hey, you want to take these kids down to this?" We said, "Sure, we'll take these kids down to it." Ah, youth group, teens, yikes. And we needed a place to stay. So we prayed up a place to stay, and somebody knew somebody who lived in this beautiful community called Spring Lake, just south of Ocean Grove, where they have all these old Victorian mansions and stuff. And a guy down there who didn't really know this group at all was opening up his house for a youth group from a church that he didn't know about to come down so they could go to Gothard. And he fed us steaks. I mean, it's like, whoa, you know, it's like the welcome mat was put out and rolled all the way down to the curb. So, you know, after housing this whole bunch of teens and, you know, strangers and feeding them, I'm out talking with the guy in his driveway that kind of overlooked the road that overlooked the ocean. And as I'm talking with him, I began to realize, I don't think this guy's a believer. So I kind of very, you know, tiptoed around the issue to try to talk about what was going to happen to him after he died. And he said he was going to go to heaven, and I kind of asked him why he thought that. And he said, well, because there's this guy down the street that goes to one of these Bible churches, and he is really a horrible kind of guy. And if he's going to get into heaven, I'm going to get into heaven. I picked my jaw up off the driveway, tried to put a smile on my face and figure out, where do I go with this? Because I didn't think anybody would actually believe this, that, you know, this guy's going to heaven, he's a horrible guy, I'm better than he is, and if he's going to be in, I'm going to be in. So we kind of talked about the fact that, you know, you don't get to heaven by your good works, you get to heaven by the fact that Jesus died for your sins, but he would not have it. It wasn't that he didn't know the truth, he didn't want it, because he wanted to view himself as better than other people. And I think when people get saved, that doesn't automatically go away. They still go around thinking, I'm a nice person, I'm going to go to heaven because I'm a good person. All my good deeds are going to be on the scale with the bad deeds, and the good are going to outweigh the bad. The problem is God says, well, what about the bad? That's sin, that's rebellion against me, that's punishable by death. If we don't have Christ dying for those sins, we're going to have to pay the penalty for them. So, you know, this shouldn't be our problem here. Luke 18:9 talks about people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. They're like the guy who goes in the temple and says, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. And, you know, they're thinking they're better than they are. The things that I think we wrestle with more are the stuff that follows down below. You know, if anybody worries about worry, you're probably susceptible to this kind of pride. It's called self-sufficiency pride. Insensitivity to our needs, insensitivity to God's grace, insensitivity to God's purposes. It results in immaturity, independence, and worry. It's like the eye saying to the hand, I have no need of you. Of course the eye and hand need each other. But the self-sufficiency pride, we need to see right over there. says, I have no needs. And when we are sensitive to the fact that, hey, we do have needs, and we're sensitive to the fact that God wants to meet our needs, then we cannot enter into that relationship where God's the one who meets our needs. This is a point that I think gets so missing in Christendom. God delights in meeting needs. That's what he specializes in. And if we don't have God meeting our needs, we're going to be looking to someone else to meet our needs. In fact, we're going to be using other people to meet our needs. Remember about 6 or 8 years ago, I did a sermon on Can God Meet Emotional Needs? And we went through the scriptures and saw that David, in particular, had this phenomenal relationship with God where God met his emotional needs. And I know for a number of people it was kind of revolutionary. If you haven't come across that outline, you might want to go find it on the website. It should be there. Not corrupted. Let's talk about 1C, self-worth pride. And by the way, if you want to ask about any of these, you can holler now. We'll spend some more time on them. Self-worth pride is one that makes us insensitive to, again, God's needs, I mean God's provisions, and results in greed, deceit, prayerlessness, bigotry, boasting, and vanity. We kind of think that everything that we have has come from us. We think we're wonderful. And this is what toddlers tend to think. They suffer from the Barney syndrome. Oh, you're so wonderful. And they hear this and they think they're great. And I referenced an article last night where people have studied college students in this generation, and they're more narcissistic than anyone else before. And they have no basis for their sense of I'm doing well. They just think they're doing well because they've been told they've been doing well, even though they're doing poorly. It's one of the reasons they hate me after I give them a midterm. All of a sudden, what, you expect us to read, write, and follow directions? That's what college is all about. So, the self-worth pride is we think that we have gotten everything by our efforts, and we don't recognize that it comes from the hand of God. If I could talk about that more if you want. Self-exaltation pride, we think the world revolves around us. We're insensitive to our finiteness. Results in self-indulgence, lust, laziness, lying, and unfaithfulness. Everything gets viewed from our frame of reference, and everything should revolve around meeting our desires. Satan only gets a couple big passages in the scripture, but one of them is in Isaiah 14. And in this, God kind of peels back the hide, and we get a peek into Satan's heart as to what he's really like. No problem. And there's a whole bunch of times when everything that he says is prefaced with, I will, I will, I will. I think it's like mentioned 7 times in Isaiah 14. And he is exalting his will. He's doing what he wants, independently of what's right and what God, his creator, wants. And we sometimes fall into that trap as well. Then there's stubborn pride. This is where we're insensitive to truth and our need to change. This frequently gets reflected. Things don't go your way and you get angry. You have an objective, the objective is being frustrated, and you blow up over the fact that it's not going your way. You're insensitive to truth and you're insensitive to your need to change. One of the churches in the book of Revelation, chapter 3, verse 17, Jesus gets on their case because he says to them, you guys say you're rich, wealthy, and have need of nothing, but you don't know the reality. The reality is that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. So here's a group of believers in a semi-persecuted environment having an incorrect view of themselves. And last but not least, Theodore, tempted with tinges of the green-eyed monster, jealousy, envy, bitterness, hate, and selfishness, follow those. You're really insensitive to your own faults, and you kind of look at someone else and say, oh, I'm doing better than they are, or I want to have what they have. And 2 Corinthians 10 says those who compare themselves to others just aren't really very wise. So by and large, most sins can be traced back to some source of an inaccurate view of yourself. You're either self-righteous, or you're self-sufficient, or you think the world revolves around you, or you don't want to change when the circumstances around you change, or you kind of look down on others to make yourself look good. All those kinds of pride cut us off from good relationships with others, and they hinder our relationship with God as well. I'm going to take a look at some of the consequences, and then we'll zip down to the corrective. Consequences of pride, Roman numeral 2, alienation, well, that means from God and others, frustration, you're not going to get what you want, and condemnation, you're actually going to get something you don't want. So this is actually a bad thing. It's not something that we can just wear as a badge and say, you know, oh, I admit my pride. It's something that you really need to do something about, and hopefully you know what to do about. I was driving in the car with the kids, and we were talking about passage in James that says, submit to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee to you, or God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And I asked the kids, well, how do you submit yourselves to God? How do you humble yourself before God? And they all had answers. You might want to think about an answer you have, but we'll get to that eventually. Okay, Roman numeral 2a, a proud person is lonely, because they're alienated from God and man. God hates pride. It's chief among the things he hates. And in case you didn't realize it, pride is sin. And you can look at all these verses on your own. I assume most people here read. And the last one under Roman numeral 2a1, not living by faith, is actually a symptom of pride. It says, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but my just shall live by faith. So if someone is living by faith, they have the right view of God and themselves, they're doing okay. Failure to do that, I think the Bible would call sin. The proud don't seek after God. They don't obey because they think they're in charge. They don't have intimacy with God. We already talked about that. And they don't fear God. Proverbs 21:24, a proud and haughty man, scoffer is his name, he acts with arrogant pride. I used to be amazed at them, now I get jaded, the number of people who will fight me on the concept of fearing God. Oh, you're just supposed to love him. Well, I know immediately I'm dealing with two things about the person that says that. Number one, they don't know their Bible. And number two, they're prideful. And then I realized, probably best to leave the situation, because the person, the truth is there if a person wants to see it. So, proud don't seek after God. And proud, put down others with their words to bolster their own sense of self-worth. We talked about that. There's a whole bunch of nasty stuff that they do, but that doesn't apply to anybody here. Let's go to the next page. B, the proud person is unsatisfied, frustrated in the pursuit of worth and the enjoyment of what they attain. This is particularly applicable to folks in our culture. We're a culture of attainment. We want to gain stuff, have stuff, and we think that stuff will give us happiness, will give us joy, will make us satisfied. The world's wisest man had all this stuff. You all know the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon had it all. I mean, now he's thinking, okay, well, what's worth doing now that I got it all? What do I do? And he had more gold, more power, more pleasure than any king before him or after him. And he wasn't really happy. That sad story at the end is his wife turned his heart away from God. But at the peak of his wisdom, he figured out, something better for a man to eat, drink, and find pleasure in his work. But this is a gift from God that he only gives to those who please him. Hence the importance of pleasing God. You want to be pleased? Please God, and then he gives you the ability to enjoy what you have. Even if what you have is little, you're not going to enjoy it. People who have little tend to think, if I only had more. And people who have more tend to think, if I only had a little more. And they never make it. This week, in my class, we met a guy called Caesar Augustus, one of the most phenomenal leaders that the world has known. He is the guy who took over after Julius Caesar got murdered on the Ides of March. Actually, that just happened. It's coming up. Beware of the Ides of March. And he was 19 years old when he took over. And his adopted father, Julius Caesar, had just been murdered by a group of corrupt senators who were living just for themselves. The Republic was in shambles. In fact, the Republic ended with the death of Julius Caesar. So, at the end of his life, when he's 70, 72 or so, Caesar Augustus lists 30 accomplishments that he had, and he writes them in bronze and has them set up on tablets in the forum. And as an assignment, I gave my class the accomplishments and had them read through them. And I asked them to note a couple ones that they thought were significant. And then I asked them to figure out, what do you think drove this guy? So here we are looking at this guy who, at the age of 19, on his own initiative and at his own expense, raises an army, drives Caesar's assassins into exile using lawful means. When they come back, on two different occasions, he fights them and defeats them. He totally reshapes Roman government. He takes it from a republic to an empire. He expands Rome's borders all over the place. He grants citizenship to 500,000 people, sets up 26 colonies, thriving towns, gave these gladiator battles where they dug out a field, 6 football fields one way and 4 football fields the other, and then had a naval battle just for the entertainment of people. He was a PR guy. He kind of knew how to keep the masses entertained. 3,000 guys fight in this battle. This is just one of his accomplishments. He has all these gladiator games and all this other stuff. So interspersed with these things where he expands the empire and turns it around, paying for soldiers' pensions out of his own money, being an honest, upright guy, there's all this phenomenal stuff. And then I start seeing stuff like, and twice the Senate closed the roads in my honor. This has never happened before. And there are a couple of others where, and my name was put in gold over the door where no one else was allowed to have their name put in gold over the door. Here's this guy who is the most powerful person on earth. And he's the thing that he lists as his major accomplishments are, they closed the roads because of me. This guy was special. Now think about it. His wealth supported, hundreds of thousands of people, yet it didn't give him pleasure. And he conquered all his enemies. He was victorious in every battle he fought. Yet that didn't do it. He had all the stuff that everyone else in the world would strive for, and he still is looking for something more. The moral of the story is, it doesn't satisfy. You will never achieve what he has achieved. And you... What?
That's true. If I'm here in New York.
Hey, never underestimate a man with an apple peeler. The world is yet to see what can happen. Look out, world, he's coming. But whatever it takes to get your worth and value from that stuff is going to be going beyond where people like Caesar Augustus have been. So he had this stuff, but it didn't satisfy him. Solomon had it all, it didn't satisfy. Nelson Rockefeller was asked, well, what does it take to satisfy? Just a little more. All these things that we seek after that satisfy are not going to satisfy, yet you can look at some people who have relatively little or almost nothing, and they can be satisfied. What's the secret? God gives you the ability to enjoy what you have. How do you get God to give you that ability to enjoy it? Make sure your ways are pleasing to Him. So under Roman numeral 2b, the proud person is unsatisfied. Let's take a look at why. Number one, God opposes the proud. He actively is there opposing the proud, yet giving grace to the humble. Verse out of 2 Samuel 22, written by David, says, "You will save the humble people. He'll come to their rescue. He'll aid them. But your eyes are on the haughty or proud, that you might bring them down." That's a scary verse to think. You're climbing up a ladder, and God's there watching, waiting for you to get high enough so He can just kind of flick you off it. The higher you go, the harder you fall. God frustrates to show that we are not in control. He talks in Leviticus 26 about, "I will break the pride of your power. I will make the heavens iron and your earth bronze." That means you're not going to get rain. You're not going to get your prayers answered. The earth is not going to bear its fruit. And as people depart from Him, God actively frustrates them. A couple others in here. Hosea 7:10, "And the pride of Israel testifies to his face. They do not return to the Lord their God, nor seek Him for all the things that He was sending as judgment against them." They still didn't turn back. A guy outside the nation of Israel, a mighty king, Nebuchadnezzar, said, "Praise and extol, exaltation, and honor, or praise, extol, and honor the King of Heavens. Those who walk in pride, He is able to put down." I think Nebuchadnezzar actually experienced that. So God is able to oppose the proud, but He does give grace to the humble. The prideful might appear to prosper, but it's just an appearance. Number two on there, Psalm 123:4. Our soul is exceedingly filled with the scorn of those who are at ease, with the contempt of the proud. So the proud are in control, and they are looking down on the humble. But pride basically sets us up for humiliation. In the middle of that paragraph, in Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Whenever I see this verse, I recall my first speech class in college, communications course. And we kind of, to get our feet wet, they gave out, you know, proverbs or aphorisms or sayings. They weren't all from the Bible. And we had to get up and say something about it in 3 minutes. So I remember this first kid, he wasn't the brightest crayon in the box, gets up, and he was given this passage. And he actually talks about it as pride is a good thing. He said, you know, my basketball team, you know, like, you know, we kind of lost our pride and then we lost the game. You know, you kind of need to keep your pride up, otherwise you lose. And I was like, oh. The point is that when you're living, thinking of yourself higher, in one sense even lower than you ought, you're set for a fall. The question that might come later is, how is it when you're living lower for yourself, you're looking for a fall? Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to it later. The proud are deceived into thinking that they're secure. There are a number of spots in the Old Testament where nations are thinking they're great. Here's one of them with Edom. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You dwell in the clefts of the rock. Your habitation is on high. You say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? And you go to Petra or wherever the place is, and you find out it's a ruin. They got brought down to the ground. And it gets worse. Not only does God bring them down, he punishes them. See, God will punish the proud. Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. And even though they join forces, none will go unpunished. So, you know, you can read through these other things. God punishes the proud. So you have God actively opposing him. So the benefits of humility are a good relationship with God and a good relationship with others. The consequences of pride is fall and getting punished. Gee, which one should we choose? Pride. No, wrong answer. You want to choose humility because that opens up the door for all kinds of things that are good in life. So let's take a look at number three, the consequences of humility. Intimacy, satisfaction, and blessing. Flip back to Romans 1:2, you should be just about the opposite. Alienation. The other thing was in there, frustration and condemnation. You know, so you're taking your pick. It's all a result of choices that you make, and the choices occur in the innermost being of your heart. Rule number one, God hears our desires, he knows our desires, and he goes about meeting them. If you're seeking God, he will bless you. We talked a lot about that last week. It is better to hang with the humble, about midway down, three quarters of the way down that paragraph from Proverbs 16:19. It's better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide spoil with the proud. God scorns the prideful, but he gives grace to the humble. The Lord lifts up the humble, casts the wicked to the ground. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. So you basically need this attitude of submitting to God. We talked last week about one of the words for humility was a depression in the ground, taking a position that's even lower than you might be entitled to, and God will bless in return. Humility spares us from wrath. 2 Chronicles 32:26. Then Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, and the wrath of the Lord that was promised did not come upon them. And then next chapter talks about he had a problem, he did not humble himself, and I think he died of his problem. So humility, when exercised, spares you from wrath. And the last part there, three, God rewards the humble. The Lord takes pleasure in his people. He will beautify the humble with salvation. One of my favorite verses out of Proverbs, Proverbs 22:4. By humility and fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. Now think about what most people seek after. Riches, honor, and life. All right, how do you get it? Two simple little things. Humility and fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord is awareness that the God who judges is watching and remembering, so you want to kind of keep your act clean before him. And then humility is you submit your desires to God and you let God run your life. You let Him run your show. You don't take things into your own hands. You give room for God to make decisions. You're praying for God to do something, He doesn't answer, you wait. You don't go and do it yourself. You wait and say, okay, what does God want me to do? It goes back to a lot of what we talked about at the beginning of the year in terms of pleasing God. You just seek to please Him. That's the function of humility. Because the reality is, we are designed to please Him. We're not designed to please ourselves. When we seek to please Him, everything else falls into place. When we seek to please ourselves, life isn't that good. Eventually God will exalt the humble, and the humble, and humble the exalted. So God is going to put things up at the end. Okay, let's talk about questions down below, or questions on what I said. Skipped a lot of stuff. If you want to come back to any of the pieces, feel free to.
As far as the types of pride, do you think that there is that men and women are drawn toward different types of pride? I mean, I hate to bring up the men and women battle, but I'm just wondering if God created men to be drawn towards the type of pride in women.
Well, that's a good question, Brian. Anybody have a thought on that?
Are men more likely to have a certain type of pride?
Yeah, they inclined to side on one side of pride more than a woman would. Are women drawn towards a type of pride than men? I think it's a good question. Anybody see any division there? How's it work in personality types?
Well, I mean, I haven't written my thesis on it.
Oh, all right.
I'm just saying people, like, certain types of pride I struggle with. I know that people with more personality, like, will share that. All right.
Go.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think pride manifests itself differently, typically in men versus women. I'll pick on the women first. It's from dangerous, but I think you'll talk about.
Oh, yeah, sure, blame me.
talk about others to make yourself feel better. You know, I just kind of observe the women in my workplace, they'll tend to be talking about others a little bit more quick to put others down. I think men also try to feel better about themselves by comparing themselves to others, but it's not too much kind of talking about others. It's more saying, you know, I ran faster or I jumped higher or whatever.
Yeah, I agree with that. Guys tend to put more credit to their accomplishments. It's a more positive kind of pride. This is a tendency. This is not an absolute.
I'm just saying, history, you know, guys tend to go out and conquer the land. Or we need to go and see what's over there and conquer it.
Well, if you look at the basic temptation of power, power, it's got two subsets, security and significance. Guys tend to be driven more by the significance factor, although in the masculinization of our feminine workforce, you know, that's, women are, for the past 20 years, have been getting a lot more of their worth and value from the fact that they've got jobs and careers. But that used to be where the guys' problems worked out more. And then women tended to be driven a lot more by significance. But it's not an either-or, by security. It's not an either-or thing, because, you know, guys both want to be secure, and women do want to be significant. When it comes to the area of pride, I had this thought. I know it was there. come back. Senior moment here. Guys tend to play up their accomplishments to appear more significant. Women tend to put down other women to build their sense of security. I'm better than she is. I'm more desirable than she is. So, you know, they tend to have a little more of a negative pride. But these are gross, stereotypical tendencies, and you're going to find both inside a person. And Vince is really in trouble when he gets home.
And both are definitely displeasing to God.
Yeah.
So it's
Yeah. Like
the same thing.
Yeah, equally displeasing, yeah. Yeah, Leanna.
For someone that, you know, doesn't have God in their life, is there really confidence in them that they're really prideful?
No, not necessarily. A lot of people tend to think that confident, competent people are prideful. The way I've been portraying pride is it's an accurate view of yourself. So for someone to do a really good job and someone compliment on the job and they go, oh, it was nothing, you know, that's actually a form of pride. It's an inaccurate view of life, and if you scrape a little deeper to see the dynamic underneath that, there's two things going on. One is, by saying it was nothing, they're saying they didn't put any effort into it, and it was really no sweat for me to do that because I'm so great. It's actually an exaltation kind of thing. And then on the other hand, they're unable to accept a compliment because of a lack of self-worth. They're denying the reality. They're actually going against truth. They did a good job, so they're going against that. And they're setting up a standard that's not the right standard. So, you know, there's either way. So there's in one sense, you can take pride in your accomplishments. So the questions down below are the legitimate forms of pride. You see people, you know, celebrating triumphs, celebrating victory. Those are legitimate things. I tell my kids, you did a good job. They did a good job. It's not like, wow, I did a good job. You know, it's like they did a good job. It's the reality. Although our kids sometimes, they do this deliberately and intentionally because they know it's funny. They'll say to their other sibling, oh yeah, Dad said I did a good job and you didn't. You know, because they understand the dynamic that people have this tendency to put others down. So, you know, we can do that as a joke. I don't know how it works in other households. Yeah, Garrett.
People who are under persecution or something, they sometimes really focus on their pride. Like, when some of you do pride when they were lost, which is about Martin Luther King, in the 60s when the African Americans really stood up basically for their rights and used pride as motivating.
Right, that's you should have pride in yourself, you should believe in yourself kind of thing. And there's a legitimate piece for that. Again, it's the reality. You know, God has given people abilities, he's given them freedoms, and they need to act in accord with that kind of stuff, not have a distorted view of reality.
Bill, I was wondering a little bit about the humility piece. If humility is kind of thinking yourself a little bit lower than others in order to think of yourself as a servant to them, right? Because that's what God would want us to do. What about a person who tends to already maybe struggle with self-esteem and they think of themselves as lower? Is that kind of just taking them in the wrong direction?
All right.
Being pushed around by others.
Good question. Let me go back to last week. I talked about the verse in Isaiah 57 where it talks about, thus says the high and haughty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in a high and holy place, but with him also is a humble and contrite spirit. We looked at the words for humble and contrite. It's on the first page of the outline, one of the first points. And those words for humble and contrite means crushed to a powder, so that one aggregate or piece of it is not discernible for another's. Kind of, you've lost your identity. It's kind of the parallel to this Christian self-denial. It's not about me anymore. So you're not standing up and you're trying to stand out among the others. You know, you can take a lowly form like Jesus did. The word for humble in that passage is of a depression in the ground. And you view yourself as lower than others. Now, Jesus in Philippians 2 exemplifies this. He left all his glory up in heaven, he comes down taking the form of a servant. Now, it's not that he thought himself better or lower or worse than his disciples. That wasn't the issue. The issue was he viewed himself as a servant of the disciples. In fact, he would not be able to have served them as he did unless he had all these benefits. We looked at the verse, for those of you just joining us last week, where in John 13, just before Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, he's having the Last Supper with his disciples. And he kicks off the meal with a John picks off the passage about the meal where there's a passage about Jesus. This is also on page one of your outline, where he says, Jesus, knowing that he had come from God and was knowing to God, come from God and was going to God, and all things were being given to him, knowing all this, having this exalted view of himself, takes off his garments, wraps himself with a towel, and starts washing the disciples' feet. It isn't really the issue of who's better or worse, but just the depression view is you view others as their needs as more important than your own. And as we view each other as more important than ourselves, in terms of needs being met, we're not concerned about our needs. And that opens up the door for God to meet our needs. And then I am totally free to meet the needs of others because God has met my needs. So by taking that position of service, I am free to serve others. Now, here's how this dovetails with the self-worth thing. Self-worth comes from being approved by God. To know that the God of the universe thinks you're great. That is the basis of self-worth. And the basic building block of self-worth is that you are knowing that you're doing the things that please the God of the universe. So taking this position as a posture as a servant where my needs aren't that important and serving others is what life is about opens up the door for me to gain value from God. Well done, good and faithful servant kind of things. Now, if a person with a, quote, bad self-worth serves because, oh, I'm horrible, I'm terrible, there's nothing else I can do, you know, it doesn't work. They lose it. They need an accurate estimation of things. God has made me. He's equipped me. His spirit energizes me. He gives me all I need to do his will, hence I can take steps to do it. As I do it, I gain favor with God. My service is rejected. No biggie. God's pleased with me. And that boosts the sense of worth or value. Wow, I've been worthy to suffer persecution for the sake of righteousness. Now, some people will take the posture of a servant because they have no ego strength of themselves, and that you don't get any credit for that. That's basically using someone else, if someone did this, to meet their own needs. I'm feeling really down, so I will go help someone who's more down than me. Alright, that's a common thing. It's actually a nice Christian-y thing. It's something that's, you know, sometimes useful for doing. But if you kind of examine that a little more closely, what's going on as a person is using that other person's needs to make themselves feel good. Yeah.
Your description of the man.
Yeah, extremely. Exactly. Yeah, he's meeting others' needs, so he feels good. You know, look at me. I've opened up my house to all these people and come in. And whenever a person is trying to get worth and affirmation from someone else, it points to the fact that they're not getting it from God. And the trick to getting it from God is simply submitting to God. Okay, God, I do it your way. You know, I from here on in, it's what you want, not what I want. But when a person has a bad relationship with God, they have no sense of the fact that God is pleased with them. Hence, they have to find some other thing to boost their worth and value. So, I'm not sure if I totally hit the spot you were going. Or someone else want to add to it.
I think someone who struggles with self-esteem, maybe hearing some of this, would say, oh, okay, I've got to view myself as lower, but the takeaway is, you know, it's not an issue of being better or worse. It's an issue of choosing to put your needs second so you can meet someone else's needs.
Right, the actual phrase in Philippians is consider the others more important than yourselves. So that's not necessarily to say they are. And you certainly don't want to neglect things that God wants you to do in your life to serve someone else. I mean, that's the whole point of being spirit-controlled, is the Spirit of God is controlling your decisions, and you're not doing it for your own motives. You're doing it because God wants you to. So, you know, you can consider someone as more important, even though that in reality they aren't. Yes, Elaine? God rewards spirit-directed, other-centered, edifying speech. It says, Ephesians 4:29 says, don't let any corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but only what's good for the use of edification, that it might minister grace to the hearer. So in that kind of situation, you view yourself as a servant or minister of grace, God's grace, to that person. Now, what do you tell them or what do you not tell them? What's going to be best for them? What's in their best interest? You know, there's this difference between transparency and full disclosure. Relationships are almost impossible if there's constant full disclosure. There's honesty, but you don't always have to say everything that is true, because that might not help the person at that point. So if they ask you to do something and you can't do it, you have to basically go to God and say, okay, God, what do I really say? This is where it's great to have that prayer without ceasing thing cultivated, because you can know what to say. Because there are times when, you know, God's scheme in this person's life is not for them to have the whole truck dumped on them. That wouldn't be the loving or edifying thing to do. And in order to not dump the whole truck on them, maybe you need to hold back and do something that would be more encouraging. So it's a really tricky area. And I'm sure you can't go into specifics, but you kind of need the specifics to be able to say, well, what would be the right thing to do in there? But the general principle is your speech has always got to be guided by what's in that person's best interest. And what's in that person's best interest is something that the Spirit of God knows. He's going to communicate that to you either directly, through the Word, through some counsel. I mean, God will always give you what you need to do as well. You just need to figure out what it is.
From a practical sense, not to mention the good act is a way of avoiding pride, avoiding the possibility of falling into pride. We're taught, the Lord teaches us not to lay claims to our good works and our prayers, lest we might be rewarded and have those rewards in heaven.
Right. Good point. Steve?
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to explain this, but let's just take an example where you have someone who's been a believer for 10 years, a new believer comes in, and this 10-year-old believer is discipling the younger one. And I'm trying to figure out the dynamic between being humble and serving that person, and then at the same time trying to help them see some things they need to change in their life. You could walk away saying, oh, I need to serve this person and do whatever that person needs. And, you know, at a certain point, the person, you know, is like a dog returning to vomit, and it's a constant sin, and you kind of, at some point, have to say, that's sin. But you might think, oh, well, that's not being humble.
Very good question, Steve. Everybody understand the tension? The simple answer is, love will always do what's in someone else's best interest. So you simply have to ask, what's in this person's best interest? Is it in their best interest to return to their vomit again and again? The answer is probably no. So you kind of need to short-circuit that. Then the issue becomes, how do you short-circuit that? And I did a series a decade or so ago, maybe, on Ministries for Garden Variety Christians. And we looked at the different words in the New Testament that God said believers are supposed to do with each other. And there was a paradigm, which is filtered through outlines through the years, of there's a progression in loving someone and loving them by speaking the truth to them, where there's warning and admonishment. So it's like you see someone headed off a cliff, don't do that! Spar down! You know, and then there's reproof, and that's where the word for reproof means to actually bring to light. When you walk in that direction, you get closer to the cliff and look at those rocks. You don't want to do that. Then it goes up to rebuke. You know, stop! And then there's finally a rejection. You know, well, if you're going to jump off the cliff, you know, that's going to basically end our relationship. Your choice. So there's this progression that's supposed to go on. So in that kind of relationship where you're trying to help someone grow and move them further along the path that God has for them, you know, the question we should be asking ourselves is, well, what does God want me to do and say to this person? So you need to cultivate a semi-subjective understanding of God's will in that situation so you know what to say. I am clearly not an advocate of just, you know, be all positive and wonderful. there's a lot of illustrations in the scriptures where it shows there's a parallel between spiritual growth and biological growth. So if you take the lessons from parenting, when you're trying to help someone develop into a fully functioning, mature adult, you don't let them do whatever they want. That develops a very narcissistic kind of person. You need to warn them. But on the other hand, you don't become oppressive in your warning. So you kind of need to figure out, okay, what's the most helpful next step for them to take, and then guide them toward that step. And then you go through admonishment, reproof, rebuke, if necessary, rejection, to get them to that point. Then what's the next step? So you don't let things go unchecked. You know, there's things that are difficult to deal with, and they need to be addressed. And on the other hand, to balance, counterbalance that with what I was mentioning to Elaine, you know, they might not be ready to see the real truth about themselves. It's like people, I've yet to see someone come to Christ and say, okay, tell me everything that's wrong and let's see how God and I can fix it. You know, because they never say that. It's like they learn to cover up immediately. Oh, I'm a sinner. Okay, but yeah, that was last week. Now I'm okay. Everything's fine. And, you know, so there's the bit about, okay, dropping the mask, being real, and, you know, saying, okay, now let's see what's the next step that we can take. And that's a process. Some people never go through it. You know, you see old people wearing masks just like, you know, they were when they were wearing them young. They never kind of matured, never grew. And they're still trying to use people to meet their own needs. Hey, Brian.
What do you think heaven will be like as far as pride issue? I mean, I come to understand that what's going to happen in this life is there's going to be a flip, basically. If you're like on this pen, if you can move yourself over, this is pride and this is being humble. If you can move yourself to being humble side of the pen, what God's going to do is you're going to flip it. So you will be, first will be last, last will be first. But when we're in heaven, are we still going to be serve, I mean, I'm sure when we still with high people that are once were servants here, are they going to still try to be servants in the kingdom, or are they going to just be able to sit there and be like, well, hey, you can serve me now, I served you back on earth, and now it's my turn, and it's for eternity.
Sounds like a really good deal to get in on. It'll last for a long time. Well, a truth that's emphasized repeatedly in Scripture is in the future, the humble will be exalted and the exalted will be humbled. And there does appear to be a hierarchy in the future kingdom. So those who are expecting to be served now will wind up serving in the future. Whether they like it or not, I don't know. I was just flipping through C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce this morning. It's a book where it takes a bus tour to heaven. And it was a scenario I was hoping to use today, but it was too long to read and it was too hard to follow. But there's this, one of the basic paradigms in there is that you kind of start out as a ghost and then you develop into a solid body being. And the solid body beings are there helping the ghost develop into solid body beings. So there's a work from his perspective that gets done. And there was a person who didn't want to sign on for this because she was ashamed that others would see her as a ghost. And as a result, she's going to stay as a ghost because she's never going to develop. You know, he was actually making a parallel here on earth. But when you mentioned heaven, I thought of it because in heaven there is service. You know, there now whether it's service to people is less likely. Angels are supposed to be serving people, so we're serving God. But I do know that there's a paradigm shift, and I do know I want to be on the side of the pen that you get split over to the upright side, because that lasts a whole lot longer than the downhill side. Well, the last question is kind of good to focus your eyeballs on for a second. How can you develop a Christ-like humility that keeps you safe from pride and reaps the blessing of intimacy with others? You can actually get a preview of what we might talk about next week, how to develop Christ-like humility in 5 minutes by following 3 easy steps. Come back and talk about that. It might last, actually, but I don't know. Okay, let's pray. Father, we come before you acknowledging that you are God and we are not. You know what's best, and we don't. You are the high and mighty one, and we are your servants and your creatures. Father, thank you that you do have future and plans for us that are good. Thank you that you are the God who can open his hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. Thank you that we can trust you for fulfilling what's best for each of us. Thank you that as we're awaiting the fulfillment by your hand, you give us grace so we can endure. Thank you that while we're waiting, you give us purpose so we can attain the brightest future possible. I pray, Lord, that we would be people who submit to you, who say, not my will, but thy will be done. That in every one of our activities, we're primarily thinking about, well, what does God want to have happen? I pray that you'd help us keep that forefront in our thinking. And I pray that as we crawl off the throne of our lives and place you where you rightly belong, you will bless us. You will make your way plain before us. You will develop among us better relationships and ones that are more pleasing in your sight. Thank you that we can trust you to accomplish this, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.